All right, we're in 1 Samuel, still in the first few chapters, but there's so many lessons in these few chapters for us to learn. Hopefully after we get through this, you can hear okay? Anyway, hopefully after we get through this, we can move more rapidly. But I want to deal with Eli again, or still. In chapter 2, of course, his sons were immoral, engaging in immoral activities. He spoke to them about the fact that they were causing others to sin, and he knew of their misbehavior, but he didn't restrain them. All he did is warn them or rebuke them in chapter 2, verse 23 and verse 24. As a result of this, a man of God came and spoke to Eli and pronounced judgment against him in chapter 2, verse 29 through verse 31. He says, this man of God speaking to Eli, said, "Why do you kick against my sacrifices and my offering which I have commanded in my habitation, and honor your sons above me?" So as he had warned them, as I suggest, the situation evidently still continued, and he did nothing about it. So he continues then in verse 30. "Therefore Jehovah, the God of Israel, says, I said indeed that your house and the house of your fathers should walk before me forever. But now, Jehovah says, be it far from me. For them that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me, I will lightly esteem." And so the judgment is the fact that God is going to bring the house of Eli to an end. As we come over to the third chapter, where God speaks to Samuel in the night, and he tells Samuel of the coming judgment against him. Let's see, in chapter 3, what are we going to do? Beginning with verse 11, Jehovah said to Samuel, "Behold, I will do a thing in Israel at which both the ears of everyone that hears shall tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli and all that I have spoken from the beginning even unto the end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever." And I want to emphasize this idea of forever. "For the iniquity which he knew, because his sons did bring a curse upon themselves, and he restrained them not." And so again, as you look at the context, judgment is going to be brought against the house of Eli. But as we look at the Bible, actually we find it didn't happen quickly or soon. And I think that's an important or significant lesson for us. I've used the illustration before. When I see somebody do something wrong, I want to tell everybody, jump back, lightning's going to strike. It doesn't happen that way. And it didn't happen that way in this situation. As we look at the chart we have up here, Eli had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and we read in chapter 4 that they were killed. But Phinehas had two sons. Ichabod was born in the fourth chapter, and he also had another son, Ahitub, because come to chapter 14, Ahijah is the son of Ahitub, the brother of Ichabod, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. So the family is still continuing. We get to 1 Samuel chapter 22, where Saul kills all the priests, 85 of them in the city of Nob. One of them was Ahimelech, the brother of Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. But Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David, and he was with David all the days of that David lived and served the people of Israel. But then we come to 1 Kings chapter 2. Solomon is now king. David is giving him final instructions concerning things that he is to do in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 26 and verse 27. "And unto Abiathar," that's the gentleman up here, unto Abiathar the priest, says the king, get to Anathoth and unto your own fields, for you are worthy of death. But I will not at this time put you to death, because you bore the ark of the Lord of Jehovah before David my father, and because you were afflicted in all wherein my father was afflicted. So Solomon thrust out Abiathar from being priest unto Jehovah, that he might fulfill the words which Jehovah, which he spoke concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. The thing I'm trying to emphasize in this is the fact God works in his own time and in his own way to fulfill his word. And sometimes we may think, well, God's not going to do anything. I've gotten away with it. God hasn't responded. God hasn't judged me. God does not reckon time the way we reckon time. And again, God in his own way, not ours, and in his own time, not ours, will execute his judgment. So we don't want to make the mistake that it seemed like there is a delay in the judgment of God. It's not going to occur. But actually, indeed, the judgment will occur. We've looked at the sin of Hophni and Phinehas. We've looked at the failure of Eli. And so the question is, how is Samuel living and conducting himself in this environment? There's ungodliness on the part of Hophni and Phinehas, who are supposed to set forth an example for him. And the sacrifices, the people are being corrupted. Israel is made to sin. Eli's not doing anything about it. And so as Samuel is in this environment, the question is, how is he being impacted and influenced by the world around him? Go back, if you would, to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 11. After we have the song of Hannah, Elkanah went back to Ramah to his house, and the child did minister unto Jehovah before Eli the priest. Continuing in this, as we look at chapter two, verse 18, after we read of the sins of Hophni and Phinehas and how they polluted the sacrifices, verse 18 says, but Samuel ministered before Jehovah, being a child. Dropping down to verse 21, after Eli blesses Elkanah and Hannah, promising that they will have children. Verse 21 says, and Jehovah visited Hannah, and she conceived and bare three sons and two daughters, and the child Samuel grew before Jehovah. Coming down to verse 26, this is after Eli does at least rebuke his sons for their behavior. Verse 26 says, and the child Samuel grew on and increased in favor both Jehovah and also with men. Almost makes us think of the passage scripture in Luke chapter 2, verse 52, where Jesus grew in stature and in wisdom, in favor with God and in favor with men. And so Samuel then, in this environment, is still growing and still ministering before Jehovah. Chapter 3, verse 1. And the child Samuel ministered unto Jehovah before Eli. And the word of Jehovah, the American Standard Translation says, was precious in those days, and there was no frequent vision. The idea of precious means rare. And so during his day, the word of Jehovah was rare. That wasn't being taught much, wasn't being discussed much, wasn't being studied much. It was something that was rare. But under these circumstances, we read the child Samuel ministered unto Jehovah before Eli. Dropping down to verse 19 through verse 21. After God has spoken to Samuel and told him what he's going to do to the house of Eli, and Eli puts Samuel under an oath to tell him what God had said, and he tells Eli, and verse 18 ends where Eli said, it is Jehovah let him do what seems good to him. One more time in verse 19 through verse 21. And Samuel grew, and Jehovah was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan, the city furthest to the north, to Beersheba, the city furthest to the south, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of Jehovah. And Jehovah appeared again in Shiloh. For Jehovah revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh, how? By the word of Jehovah. The first verse in chapter 4, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Once more, there's another lesson for you and me today. We live in a society that's extremely immoral. I just noticed today that a transvestite has been elected to the United States Senate. Immorality is endorsed and supported, and people celebrate the immorality. You and I are trying to live in this type of a society. Samuel did not live in the most conducive society, but through all of it, he ministered to Jehovah, and he grew, and the people begin to recognize the character of Samuel. Now, my point is this. In the day and the time in which we live, the society in which we live, we can be like Samuel. It's not dependent upon the rest of the world, because in the days of Samuel, it was corrupt. In our day, it is corrupt. But brethren, you and I, despite what the world does, should live our lives before God. And then in time, people can see the type of life that we live. Matthew chapter 5, verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. That's what it was with Samuel. And what is the result? They will glorify God. I'm always impressed with Matthew chapter 5, verse 16. It didn't say, let your works or let your light shine before men that they can see your good works and glorify you. We're not to draw attention to ourselves, but the lives that we live should be lives that draw attention to God. All right, any thought, any comment on the first three chapters? All right, then we will pass on to chapter 4. In chapter 4 through chapter 6, we read of the war against the Philistines. As you read the books of history in the Old Testament, there's a great deal concerning the Philistines. And in fact, in some of the prophecies, we read about the Philistines. In the book, Israel and the Nations, by F.F. Bruce, he said, the downfall of the Mycenaean, I guess the way you pronounce it, the Mycenaean and Hittite empires toward the end of the 13th century uprooted many of the population of the Aegean lands and sent them forth over the eastern Mediterranean in search of new homes. One such group is called the Philistines. They were from the southwest of Asia Minor. Some of the Philistines settled in Crete. Others attempted to land on the Egyptian coast, and when they were repulsed, and Egyptian history records this, when they were repulsed, they sailed to the east and landed on the Mediterranean coast in the land of Canaan. There were five city-states, five rulers among them. One was in Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gath, and Gaza. And so as we read in our text, we read about the lords of the Philistines. Well, that's the rulers of these five cities. And one of the interesting things is that we don't notice it till you get over to chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13. As Saul is now king and he's gone to war against them. Let's see, chapter 13, verse 19 and verse 20. And there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. But all Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his axe and his coulter, that is, his sickle or his plowshare, and these various implements that he used for farming. Yet they had a file for these various instruments of farming, but the children of Israel had none. The point is, the Philistines used iron weapons, but the children of Israel didn't have any. Only Saul and only his son Jonathan had swords. The Philistines were kind of benevolent dictators, if you would. They pretty much left Israel to themselves without going in and plundering and stealing their cattle and stealing their crops and so forth. But they just kept the children of Israel under their thumb. And so these are the people then that the children of Israel are going to go to battle against. I don't know if we're going to be able to make it out. Get over here and I'll try. Well, I've done it now. Thank you, Kevin. I was going to show you where the five cities of the Philistines were. Just to very briefly jump ahead while he's already taking care of me. Now let's see. If I find what I'm supposed to be, there it is. Okay. Ashdod right there is one of the cities. Ashkelon is one of the cities. Gath is one of the cities. Ekron is one of the cities. And Gaza is one of the cities. These are the five cities of the Philistines, each one with his own lord, that is, his own ruler over them. They go to war with the children of Israel, and the Philistines set themselves in array at, I won't say Ashdod, I keep forgetting, the Aphek is the name of the city. And Aphek is going to be up right about there, is where Aphek is. So these lords of the Philistines have gone north up here to Aphek, and Aphek is going to be a city that we read about several times with the battles and the conflict that takes place there. I'm skipping ahead. I'm getting ahead of myself. I want to point out some more about Samuel before we get to this. In this battle, the children of Israel are defeated, the Ark of the Covenant is captured, and it's under these circumstances then, after all these years of preparation, Samuel finally steps forward. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, where Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you do return unto Jehovah with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts unto Jehovah, and serve him only. And with this, then the people put away their idols. Samuel brings about a national repentance. Another lesson for us. Sometimes we get impatient. God's not using me the way I want to be used. I'm not being able to use all my talents like I want to. And begin to be impatient. I talked earlier about the idea that God in his own way and in his own time executes judgment. God waits and prepares us and equips us. And in his time, he will use us. The thing is, we need to keep preparing ourselves. We need to keep working. We need to keep studying. We need to keep praying. We need to keep developing our character. And then at the right time, God will use us in his service. Going back up just a few verses, we see that the Ark of the Covenant was 7 months in the land of the Philistines. The Philistines have returned the Ark of the Covenant to them. And we say that it is in the house of Abinadab in Kiriath Jearim for 20 years. Now, we can read on in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, where David went to the house of Abinadab in Kiriath Jearim and got the Ark of the Covenant and brought it back to the city of Jerusalem. But our text says it was just there 20 years. Well, it had to be there longer than that, because after Samuel, Saul reigned for 40 years, and then after Saul, then David comes to the throne. I believe the 20 years that's referred to here is 20 years after the Ark of the Covenant was returned. That's when Samuel came forth and led the people to repentance. All this time, Samuel was developing, Samuel was maturing, Samuel was setting an example before others. Then God stepped forward and used Samuel to bring this repentance on the part of the children of Israel. Sometimes we get impatient, but we need to be patient, because God, in his own way, and again, in his own time, he will use us in his service. Going back to chapter 3, verse 19 and verse 20, where Samuel was established to be a prophet, we come to the book of Acts chapter 23, or Acts chapter 3, verse 23, and there Samuel is considered to be the first of the prophets, as Peter is speaking to the people of the city of Jerusalem concerning Jesus. He says, all the prophets, from Samuel, as many as spoke thereafter, spoke of these days. So when you want to give consideration to the prophets, the children of Israel look to Samuel as if Samuel were the first of the prophets. In 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 20, it appears as if Samuel started the school of the prophets. This is where David is fleeing from Saul. Saul finds out that he's gone to Samuel at Ramah. And so Saul sends soldiers to get him. And it says that the soldiers saw the prophets and Samuel standing before them. Actually, going back to chapter 10, as Samuel is speaking to Saul, saying he's going to be the king, he gives him certain signs. A man's going to tell you that the donkeys have been recovered. Others are going to give you 2 loaves of bread and a skin of wine, and you're going to meet prophets. And it's after Samuel that we keep reading about prophets. Last night in the men's Bible class, Jacob pointed out concerning Obadiah and the days of Ahab and Jezebel, how he hid 100 prophets, and 50 of them in each cave, he gave them bread and gave them water. There are several prophets. The school of the prophets, I think, is the term that's used in 2 Kings. Samuel is the one that's believed to have started the school of the prophets. Now, we should talk about all these prophets. Anybody have any idea what a prophet is? Sometimes we think a prophet is one that gives prognostications, one that predicts the future. But that wasn't a primary function of a prophet. A prophet is one who speaks the mind and the counsel of God, revealing to men that which cannot be known by natural means. Now, what do I mean by natural means? We can look at biology, and we can look at plant life, and we know there is a designer, there must be a ruler, must be a source of origin for all things. But who is it? What is our relationship to him? Why are we here? What is our destiny? What does he expect of us? Well, that's where prophets come in. They reveal to us things that cannot be known by natural means. I cannot understand what God wants of me by looking at the leaf of a plant, or by watching a ladybug go across the porch, understand my destiny or my fate. This is the role that prophets played. And so a Samuel was considered to be the first of the prophets, all the prophets from Samuel and those that spoke after. And as Samuel started the school of the prophets, he started the school of those who spoke the mind and the counsel of God to the people. He started the school of those who revealed those things that cannot be known by natural means. It all goes back to Samuel that we're giving consideration to in our study. We'd already noted the idea that he was a prophet. Chapter 7, verse 15 says that he was a judge. And also at the same time, we see that Samuel offered sacrifices. So during this period of time, Samuel also served as a priest. He was a prophet, he was a priest, he was a judge. And we come over to the New Testament, and Jesus is a prophet. The book of Hebrews, he is our priest, and he is a king. In this respect, then, it appears as if Samuel served as a type of which Jesus is an antitype in this. With that now, let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4. And in 1 Samuel chapter 4, as I suggest, the Philistines, they were encamped at Aphek. A little to the east of there, the children of Israel were encamped at Ebenezer. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined in battle, Israel was smitten before them, that is, smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. It's interesting, this word slew. There are three or four different words that's translated slay or kill or murder. The word that is used here is a word carries the idea of wounded or put down. And so as you look at 4,000 of them were slain, they really weren't slain, but they were wounded. They were, so to speak, put out of action. For instance, you drop down just a few verses in verse 11. The ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Hophni and Phinehas, or two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. This is a different word than the word that we find in verse 2. Again, the emphasis being they were smitten, they had injuries inflicted upon them. And so a number of times when we're reading in the Old Testament and we see an astronomical amount of men were slain, that's this word here. They were wounded, they were inflicted with injury. After the Philistines have beaten them on the first day, the children of Israel ask in verse 3, "Why has Jehovah smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us, that it may come among us and save us out of the hand of our enemies." This displays a mindset that false prophets at that time demonstrated. You have, I believe it's Zedekiah in the days of Ahab, and Jehoshaphat, where they're considering going to battle against Ramoth Gilead. And Jehoshaphat asked for a prophet. And Zedekiah and all the false prophets in Israel say, "Go up, God's going to deliver it into your hand." Later in the days of Jeremiah, I believe it was Jeremiah chapter 27, where Jeremiah put a yoke upon his neck and said that the nation of Judah and the nations round about are going to have to bear the yoke for the Babylonians. Well, Hananiah, a prophet, broke the yoke and accused Jeremiah of being a false prophet, said in 2 years, Jehoiakim is going to return from captivity. All the children of Israel is going to return from captivity. And all the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar has taken from the temple is going to return. The mindset that these individuals expressed was a belief that they could influence God's actions by their predictions. In other words, I predict it. Now God is compelled to do what we want. They believed that their word influenced God. Well, I think we have the same type of thing here. We're being defeated. Let's get the Ark of the Covenant and bring it into battle. That will force God to come with us. Or like the false prophets think that they can force God to do certain things simply by uttering their prophecy. We can force God to come with us and we'll be victorious. The Philistines, they hear, as the Ark of the Covenant comes among the children of Israel, the Philistines hear the shout that's coming up from the camp of the Israelites. And in verse 7, the Philistine, this is 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 7, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God is coming to the camp. And they say, woe is us, for there has not been such a thing before where a nation forces the God to come into them. And in verse 8, woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all manner of plagues in the wilderness. It's very interesting. What they're referring to is something that had happened over 400 years earlier. And what God had done in the land of Egypt was not done in a corner. But all other nations knew about it. Going back to Exodus chapter 9, God said, I'm going to bring these plagues upon you that all nations shall know about me and my power. And in Miriam's song in Exodus chapter 15, talks about fear has come upon the Philistines and other nations. They knew what happened in the land of Egypt. When they come to Rahab in the city of Jericho, she rehearses some 40 years after it actually occurred. She rehearses what God has done. She says, I know that Jehovah, He is God. And so as time passes, we come down to the time of Samuel and the children of Israel as they go to battle against the Philistines. We find them saying, we remember what God has done to the Egyptians. So God's miracles that he performed in Egypt had a long-lasting effect upon them. They go into battle the next day. By the way, in verse 9, he tells them, be strong, quit yourselves like men. In the latter part of that verse, it says, quit you like men. So in verse 10, the Philistines fought against Israel and had smitten them, and every man fled to his tent, and there was a very great slaughter, and there were in Israel 30,000 footmen, or there fell in Israel 30,000 footmen. Now, first of all, remember as we looked at that word in verse 2, it simply means to wound or to inflict. So when they fell, doesn't mean they were killed, but some were killed, yes, but others were wounded, had injuries inflicted upon them. There's another thing. We're going to be noting a number of numbers as we go through the books of history. Here's 30,000. When the Ark of the Covenant goes back to Beth Shemesh in chapter 6, and the men of Beth Shemesh open it up, it says 50,000 of them were slain. There are 50,000 men in Beth Shemesh. And the problem is the manner in which they wrote numbers. For example, we'll go to Roman numerals. The letter I stands for what? Anybody? All right, one. V stands for what? Five. X stands for what? All right, 50. You get to L, what does that stand for? Y'all know your Roman numerals, don't you? All right, what does L mean? 50. C, what is that? 100. An M. All right, and the point is that various letters stood for numbers. And you string all these letters together. I remember going to the movies, and they'd give the date of the movie, and it's in Roman numeral. I'd be sitting there trying to figure it out. Of course, it'd go off the screen before I ever got it figured out. Well, the Hebrews did the same thing. letters stood for numbers. And the Hebrew letters, of course, are very different from the I, V, X, L, C, and M. They were very similar. And so they had difficulty determining exactly what was meant there. Is this a word or is this a number? And so as you go through, and you read about 50,000 men in Bethshemesh being killed by looking into the Ark of the Covenant, there's difficulty determining what that number actually meant. And so we need to be careful as we go through the Old Testament and look at these things. All right, the Ark of the Covenant is taken. We come to chapter 5. Now the Philistines had taken the Ark of God, and they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Again, Ashdod is going to be the furthest north city. One of the reasons why the Ark of the Covenant is taken by the Philistines, that when people went to war and defeated another nation, they would capture their gods and take them home with them. There's an inscription among the Assyrians where they're carrying the god of a city or a kingdom back to Nineveh as a captive. Remember when, I can't think of his name now, among the Assyrians that went to Jerusalem and stood outside the walls and asked them, where are the gods of all these various cities? They weren't able to do anything. What had the Assyrians done? They had captured those gods and took them back. The Philistines are doing the same thing here. They've defeated the children of Israel. They have captured that which symbolized their god and carried it back to the city of Ashdod and set it in the temple of Dagon. Now, Dagon is a very interesting individual. Idol. Among the children of, not children of Israel, but among the Canaanites and the nations round about, you have Baal and Balaam, plural. These are gods of fertility. And Dagon also was a god of fertility, but an interesting, unique one. From his waist on up had the image of a man, but from the waist on down had the image of a fish. I don't know if that's because they lived along the coastline, they went fishing, or what the situation was. But this is Dagon. Again, he's the one that would send the rain. He was the one that made the ground fruitful. He was a god of fertility. So they have taken the Ark of the Covenant, set it in the temple next to Dagon. You've been defeated. Your gods are impotent now. We rule over your gods. But they get up in the morning, and behold, Dagon, their god, has fallen upon his face on the ground before the Ark of Jehovah, delivering a message. Yes, you've got your god, but the God of the Ark of the Covenant is greater than your god. So they set it back up, and the next day they come in, and lo and behold, Dagon has fallen on the threshold of the temple. Both palms of the hands are cut off. The head of Dagon is cut off. And so once more, the message is clearly set before them that the God of the Ark of the Covenant is greater than your God. But in verse 6, the hand of Jehovah was heavy against them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them. The American Standard Translation says, with tumors. And what these tumors were, they were eating ulcers. They were swellings that the people had. And so this plague has come over the city of Ashdod. And not only that, and we read on in the next chapter, that there was a plague of mice, because one of the send the Ark of the Covenant back to the children of Israel, they set these gold images of the tumors and mice, and we'll have to quit there. I thank you for your time and your attention this evening.